sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short hair.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl.
On today's show, you'll hear the first part of a speech given by Canadian foreign policy analyst Stephen Gowans, discussing his new book, Washington's Long War on Syria. And that will be followed by some announcements of upcoming events and a new book by David Ray Griffin. Stephen Gowans goes deeper into what motivates the U.S. and its allies to attack and destroy not just Syria, but Iraq and Libya also. I learned some new things from listening to this speech. I think you will too. This is a recent speech he gave in New York City, sponsored by the Hands Off Syria Coalition. And here he is, Stephen Gowans.
Hello. So, this book, I should emphasize this, this book is a book about U.S. foreign policy. That's the principal reason this was written. It's an examination of U.S. foreign policy. What I'll do is I'll summarize the book for you in about 30 seconds, and then I'll elaborate on some of the themes in the book, and then I'll take you through a more detailed look at Washington's long war on Syria, the actual war rather than the book. So, let me start with the central idea. The central idea of this book is that the wealthy have, and this is not an unusual idea, it's hardly unique to me, but the wealthy have an inordinate influence on the formation of public policy in the United States, including foreign policy, most especially foreign policy. U.S. foreign policy is structured to promote and defend the interests of billionaire investors and shareholders of U.S. banks and corporations. Washington would like the land, the labor, the resources, the markets of the Arab and Muslim world to be used for the benefit of U.S. bankers, U.S. shareholders of large corporations. By contrast, Syria, under the leadership of Bashar al-Assad, the current president, and before him, his father, the previous president, Hafez al-Assad, wanted the land, labor, resources, and markets of Syria and the larger Arab world to be used for the uplift of Syrians and for the uplift of Arabs. So there's therefore a fundamental contradiction between U.S. foreign policy and the Syrian government. They seek antagonistic goals. This contradiction has been present since at least 1963. 1963 is when the Arab nationalists came to power in Syria. I'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. And the United States has sought to resolve that contradiction in its favor for at least the last six decades. Hence the title of the book, Washington's Long War on Syria. A more fitting title may have been Wall Street's Long War on Syria, which indeed was the working title. And it's the title I wanted, but apparently publishers have some influence over matters like this, so it became Washington's Long War on Syria. Some people, including those who write reviews in Quill and Quire, which reviewed this book recently, and others who are enamored of the work of Noam Chomsky, say that this view is far too simple, that the conflict in Syria is much more complicated than that. But they usually stop there without explaining why they think that view is too simple. Well, let's hear the words of the great docent of the left, Noam Chomsky. What would he say? Chomsky writes in Towards a New Cold War that to understand imperialist wars or interventionist wars, quote, it is a good idea to begin by investigating the domestic social structure. Who sets foreign policy? What interests do these people represent? What is the domestic source of their power? This is precisely the questions that this book addresses. And the book is organized, or has various sub-themes organized in chapters. So let me take you through what those sub-themes are. The first chapter is titled The Den of Arabism. I really like that phrase, the den of Arabism. It's not my phrase. And this first chapter is an examination of Arab nationalist ideology, which underlies the actions of the Syrian state and places it in conflict with the interests of Wall Street. That ideology and its hostility to the idea that Washington can and will lead a global order, a global economic order, a global political order, that ideology is best summed up by two phrases, one which comes from the Syrian constitution, the other which comes from the Syrian president. So let me tell you about the phrase that comes from the Syrian constitution. Syria's constitution defines the Syrian state as the beating heart of Arabism and the forefront of confrontation with the Zionist enemy and the bedrock of resistance against colonial hegemony in the Arab world. Syria's President Bashar al-Assad has said, quote, Syria is an independent state working for the interests of its people rather than making the Syrian people work for the interests of the United States. I said that the United States wants to lead a global economic order. That's not a motivation that I've attributed to Washington. In fact, Washington is quite open about this ambition. The phrase, the United States can and will lead a global order, comes directly from the United States 2015 National Security Strategy. It is a fascinating document, and it's readily available on the internet, and I'd recommend that all of you read it if you can. Read it because it's so astonishing. Astonishing because it's a national security document, so you'd expect that it would be about national security. Almost all of it is about economics. Almost all of it is about how to structure the planet economically. And in that national security document, the United States says unabashedly that it can and will lead the world. That it's never a question of whether the United States will lead. That the United States is the world's indispensable power. That it has primacy. That it has a leadership role. That sounds nice when you put it that way. It has a leadership role. It has primacy. The Italian philosopher Domenico Lussardo describes this another way. It says the United States there is an international dictatorship of the United States, which is another way of talking about primacy and leading the world. The second chapter of this book is titled Regime Change, and it is an examination of two forces which have worked to bring about regime change in Damascus since the middle 1950s. They've worked sometimes separately, sometimes together. The first force is the United States government under the sway of the U.S. business-owning class. And the second force is the Muslim Brotherhood, the ideological antecedent of Al-Qaeda and ISIS. I should hasten to add that it's also the ideological antecedent of more moderate groups, Islamic groups. In Syria, the Muslim Brotherhood is committed to violence as a means of bringing about political change. The Muslim Brotherhood in some other countries is not committed to violence. It's committed to participating in elections. Why the difference? Well, the Muslim Brotherhood's committed to violence in Syria. One of the reasons why is because the Syrian constitution bans political parties based on religion. That means that the Muslim Brotherhood has little recourse but to seek political change through extra-constitutional means and through violence. However, I'll talk later about why it is that there is a prohibition in Syria against political parties based on religion. The Muslim Brotherhood in Syria has worked since the early 1960s to topple the government in Damascus in order to replace it with a Sunni Islamic state. Both the U.S. government and the Muslim Brothers have worked together on efforts of regime change. Chapter 3 is titled The 2011 Distemper. This is a look at whether the uprising, which broke out in 2011, mid-March 2011, whether it was a secular democratic revolt against dictatorship and neoliberalism, as some people argue, and I'll discuss that in more detail in a few moments. Chapter 4 is titled The Myth of the Moderate Rebel, and it is an examination of who the insurgents are, the insurgents that the U.S. government labels as moderates, and what their relationship is to the non-moderate rebels, especially Al-Qaeda. Moderate rebels were defined. The interesting thing about the phrase moderate is that moderate is used to connote rather than denote. It's used to suggest something. Moderation is something good. There was never, this was a deliberately constructed phrase of deception. And we know that because if you ever read press reports about the moderate rebels, it might have occurred to you to ask, what is meant by moderate anyway? I know what they want me to think. Moderate, that sounds like pacific, inclined to discussion, perhaps pluralistic. Well, what was really meant was finally revealed by then head of U.S. intelligence, James Clapper, who was talking to the Council on Foreign Relations. The Council on Foreign Relations is kind of a lobby group on behalf of Wall Street. And he said, well, the moderate rebels are any rebels other than ISIS. That's the definition of moderate. Anyone other than ISIS. Irrespective of their orientation toward democracy, irrespective of the methods they use, irrespective of their goals or their ideology. They're simply called moderate simply because they were not ISIS. The moderate rebels, in fact, in the main, are Islamists whose goal is not democracy, but a Sunni Islamic state. They are, in the main, insurgents who use terrorist methods. Not exclusively. They also use other methods of guerrilla warfare, but they also use terrorist methods. And they cooperate on the battlefield with Al-Qaeda. They are enmeshed with Al-Qaeda. They work under license to Al-Qaeda. They are auxiliaries of Al-Qaeda. And they pass their U.S.-supplied weapons to Al-Qaeda. It's fascinating. You don't see it much anymore, but the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, Washington Post would talk about U.S.-trained rebels, and they used all kinds of phrases to describe the relationship of those rebels to Al-Qaeda. They said they were enmeshed with them, they were entangled with them, they were cooperating on the battlefield with them, they were sharing weapons with them. Essentially, they were Al-Qaeda, but they're Al-Qaeda under another name. The name was U.S.-supplied and trained moderate rebels. Chapter 5 is titled The Ba'athist Islamic Ally. Ba'athists are the Arab nationalists. The Ba'ath Arab Socialist Party, and I emphasize socialist because that's part of the explanation for why Free Enterprise Washington is opposed to the Ba'ath Arab Socialists, and there may be some who are raising their eyes and saying, yeah, they might call themselves socialists, but are they really socialists? So, I mean, what is socialism? You can define it in many ways. But the significant question is, does the United States regard them as socialists? And is that one of the reasons why the U.S. government is hostile to the Ba'ath Arab Socialist government of Damascus? And I believe very much it is. And there's no question that the United States regards the government in Damascus as a socialist government. You can read U.S. State Department documents in which complaints are made about the socialist orientation of the government in Damascus. I'll come back to that in a second. The Ba'ath Arab Socialist Party is the party to which Bashar al-Assad belongs. It's also the party to which Saddam of Iraq belonged. The party has three major goals. Unity of the Arab world, so overcoming its religious and other differences, including laying to rest the antagonism between Sunni and Shia. Freedom from foreign domination, that's the second goal. And socialism. Socialism defined as public ownership of the commanding heights of the economy and a significant role for government in the guidance of the economy. The Arab nationalist values of unity, freedom, and socialism also inspired Muammar Gaddafi and were explicitly referred to in the constitution, the first constitution that Gaddafi had written. Gaddafi was greatly impressed by the great Arab nationalist leader, the Egyptian Gamal Abdel Nasser, whose lieutenant he aspired to become. And if you read his constitution, Gaddafi's constitution, which he originally wrote, you'll see explicit references to unity, freedom, socialism. If you read the Syrian constitutions, the one that was written in 2012, the one written by Hafez al-Assad, the current president's father, in 1973, you'll see references to unity, freedom, socialism. If you read the constitution that was prepared for Iraq by Saddam, you'll also see references to unity, freedom, socialism. These values are also implicitly present in the constitution of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And it is the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is the Ba'athist Islamic ally referred to in the chapter title. Now, the political Islam of Iran is non-sectarian. It seeks the unity of the Muslim world and the bridging of differences between Shia and Sunni. It also seeks the freedom of the Muslim world from foreign domination. And it favors an economic model which is largely indistinguishable from the economic model favored by Arab nationalists, namely a model of economic planning and public ownership of the commanding heights of the economy. So many people wonder, you know, why are Iran and Syria allies? Well, they're allies because they want the same things for the most part. But they say, Syria is secular. Iran is Islamic. So how is it that they could be allies? Especially since secular Syria is entangled in a war with Islamists. Well, the Iranians want to overcome sectarian differences in the Muslim world. And the Arab nationalists want to overcome sectarian differences in the Arab part of the Muslim world. The Iranians want to liberate the Muslim world from foreign domination. The Arab nationalists want to liberate the Arab part of the Muslim world from foreign domination. The Iranians favor a significant role for the state in the economy, and the Arab nationalists favor a significant role for the state in the economy. Those are significant reasons why Iran and Syria are allies, despite the fact that one government is secular and the other government is Islamist. Chapter 6 is titled Washington State Islamic Allies, as opposed to its non-state Islamic allies, like Al-Qaeda, for example, or the so-called moderate rebels, most of whom are Islamists. And this is a look at the Islamic countries that are allies of the United States. So if the Islamic State of Iran is an ally of Arab nationalist Syria because they share a commitment to unity and a commitment to freedom from foreign domination and a commitment to socialism, then you might expect that the Islamic allies of Washington would share a commitment to disunity in the Arab and Muslim worlds, a commitment to U.S. hegemony over the Arab and Muslim worlds, and a commitment to free enterprise. And indeed, that would be the case. Washington's principal Islamic State ally, Saudi Arabia, promotes a very divisive brand of Islam, which operates against the efforts of Arab nationalists and the Islamic Republic of Iran to overcome the sectarian differences which divide the Arab and Muslim worlds. The Saudi monarchy is also highly integrated into the U.S. financial elite and depends on the United States for protection against the Saudi population, which is hostile to the monarchy. Chapter 7 is called Divide et Impera, or Latin for divide and rule. I'm not sure why I said Divide et Impera. Maybe I felt Latin that day. And Chapter 8, Echoes of Hitler, look at the efforts of the Muslim Brotherhood, the Muslim Brothers' ally, Washington, and Washington's ally, Saudi Arabia, to divide the Arab world on religious grounds. Chapter 7 looks at how the United States restructured Iraq's political system in order to bring sectarian cleavages to the fore. In this time-honored imperialist, you know, tradition of divide and rule, Chapter 8 looks at efforts to paint Arab nationalists in Damascus who seek to bridge the Arab world's religious and other differences, but seek to describe them as an Alawi regime, using Arab nationalism as a cover to pursue a sectarian agenda. We don't see that much anymore, but say in 2016, 2015, 15, there was a lot of writing in the press which would suggest that, as they called it, the Assad regime was an Alawi regime, which was attempting to pursue some kind of sectarian agenda in Syria. There's been this conflation of the Alawi sect with Arab nationalism. It certainly comes from the Muslim Brotherhood to suggest that secular Arab nationalism is simply a cover for the Alawis to pursue their sectarian agenda. Chapter 9 is titled Wall Street's Empire, and it answers the question Chomsky posed as essential to understanding U.S. foreign policy. Who sets U.S. foreign policy? What interests do these people represent? What is the domestic source of their power? So let me just step you through an historical timeline of the conflict in Syria. So this will be a look at the Long War. In the mid-1950s, Washington conspired with London to purge Arab nationalist influence from Syria. Their target was a triumvirate of Arab nationalist and communist leaders who Washington and London perceived as threatening economic interests in the Middle East. Spearheading the effort was Kermit Roosevelt of the infamous Roosevelt family, which gave us two U.S. presidents. Kermit himself was infamous. You may know him as the man who engineered the overthrow of Iran's Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh, who committed the grave crime against Western domination of nationalizing Iran's oil industry. Roosevelt and British intelligence, MI6, planned to enlist the help of the Muslim Brothers to overthrow the three men in Damascus they saw as threatening Western economic interests. In the 1960s, the Muslim Brothers led protests, strikes, demonstrations, riots in Syria under the banner Islam or Ba'ath, by which they meant Islam or secularism, always in opposition to what the brothers called the government's godless character. In 1967, the Brotherhood declared a holy war against secular nationalists, denouncing them as infidels and enemies of God. In the 1970s, the Brotherhood established an underground paramilitary organization, anticipating the so-called rebels of today. The 1970s rebels were armed and trained outside of Syria, just as today's rebels are armed and trained outside of Syria by U.S. and Western intelligence services in Qatar and Jordan. The brothers launched a major campaign of urban guerrilla warfare, assassinating Ba'ath Arab socialists, murdering state officials, killing army officers, attacking Syrian government buildings, assaulting Syrian military installations. In 1973, Hafez al-Assad, the current president's father, oversaw the drafting of a constitution for Syria that promulgated a mission for his country. And the mission would be to foster the unity of the Arab world to overcome its religious, sectarian, other differences in order to achieve the Arab world's liberation from foreign domination and to modernize and indigenize the economy. Modernization and indigenization of the economy would be planned. This is written into the Constitution by economic planning and public ownership, what Washington would denounce as socialism. Indeed, in Washington, Assad was denounced as an Arab communist. He wasn't a communist. In fact, he was suspicious of communists, and communists were suspicious of him. But from Washington's perspective, he may as well have been a communist, because the policies he implemented had effects on corporate America equal to the effects of policies that communists would have implemented. In the 1980s, Robert Baer, a CIA officer who'd served in the Middle East for three decades, found that Syria was, quote, the epicenter of Islamic terrorism. Baer wrote, "When I first set foot in Damascus in 1980, I estimated that Assad had maybe 3 or 4 years before he went under. The Muslim Brothers owned the street. The mosque schools were teaching jihad. The mosque public address system blared out a message of hate and revenge. I figured this guy's going to get strung up on a light pole in downtown Damascus, along with a whole lot of other Syrians." In the 1980s, the brothers established an Islamic Front for Syria, whose manifesto declared a war without end until Ba'ath Arab socialism was exterminated in Syria. In 1982, Muslim Brothers seized control of Hama, Syria's fourth largest city. They went on a blood-soaked rampage. They attacked police stations. They murdered any Ba'ath Arab socialist they could find. They executed government officials. They killed soldiers. Every Ba'ath Arab Socialist Party official in the city was executed, many by decapitation. In the Syrian government operation to quell the uprising, the Syrian Arab Army captured more than 15,000 foreign-supplied machine guns, along with prisoners, including Jordanian and CIA-trained paramilitaries. Likewise, insurgents operating in Syria today have been trained by the CIA and other Western intelligence services in Qatar and Jordan, as I mentioned. In the 1990s, the Muslim Brotherhood established an alliance with other sectarian or Sunni sectarian Sunni political Islamists to form what became known as the National Front for the Salvation of Syria, but perhaps was more aptly called the National Front for the Salvation of Syria from secularism. The front had two goals. Its most pressing and immediate goal was the assassination of Assad. Its longer fundamental goal was to establish an Islamic state in Syria based on the Quran.
You've just been listening to a recent speech given by Canadian foreign policy analyst and author Stephen Gowan, speaking about his new book called Washington's Long War on Syria. Tune in next week to hear the second and final part of that informative speech. Stephen Gowans has a website called What's Left, and you can get to it by going to www.gowans.wordpress.com. So gowans.wordpress.com, and Gowans is spelled G-O-W-A-N-S. So gowans.wordpress.com. And now for the events and David Ray Griffin's new book. The first event is the 2017 Hiroshima Nagasaki Remembrance, A Call to Abolish Nuclear War event, which is going on Sunday, August 6th, at the Unitarian Society of Hartford from 6 to 9 p.m. It's at 50 Bloomfield Avenue in Hartford. And at 6 p.m. is a potluck, and at 6:30 the program begins with music, speakers, poetry, and a beautiful candlelighting ceremony. I highly recommend this event. I've been in the past, and it's a very moving, well-done program. To find out more information, you can go to the website www.hopeoutloud.org. And again, that's www.hopeoutloud.org. And the second event will be on Saturday, August 12th at the Juicy J Juice Bar in Hartford. It's at 494A Farmington Avenue. The Connecticut 9/11 Truth Group will be showing the first part of the film Incontrovertible at the Juicy J's Juice Bar at 7 p.m. And again, that's Saturday, August 12th. So come and join us for some healthy food and drink from the Juicy J Juice Bar and see this incredible film that presents the evidence that explodes the official story of 9/11. And again, that's Saturday, August 12th at the Juicy J Juice Bar, 494A Farmington Avenue in Hartford at 7 p.m. And now for the new book by Dr. David Ray Griffin. As many of you know, Dr. David Ray Griffin has written 11 books on 9/11, challenging the official story. And his latest book has just come out. It's called How Bush and Cheney Ruined America and the World. And the first two-thirds of the book are about Bush and Cheney in the aftermath of 9/11. And the last third of the book is about the miracles of 9/11. So again, this book has just been released, and it's called How Bush and Cheney Ruined America and the World. And also stay tuned, because David Ray Griffin will be joining me on the show in a few weeks to discuss this new book. And just as a reminder, 9/11 Wake Up Call shows are archived at the website radioforall.net. And that's the digit four, so radioforall.net. And once on the site, click on Contributors, and then look for and click on Cheryl under the letter C, and the shows should pop up. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening. Power to the people, right on.